Hello and welcome to the Data Journalism Podcast. My name is Simon Rogers. I'm a data journalist, speaker and teacher and data editor at Google.
And I am Alberto Cairo. I am a professor of visualization at the University of Miami. I am an infographics designer and journalist and also a book author.
We love using data to tell stories, and the music you can hear is the sound of data made with two-tone, an app that turns numbers into tunes. And it's also the sound of San Francisco, which is relevant to our guest this week.
And this is the Data Journalism Podcast, the only podcast, as far as we know, and at least so far, dissecting the latest trends in data journalism around the world. In each episode, we explore the latest in data journalism and we chat with some of the world's top data journalists. You will get to find out how they do what they do.
So subscribe at datajournalismpodcast.com to see how data is changing the world of journalism forever. Alberto, how are you doing?
Doing all right, Simon. How are you doing?
We are good. And we just had a great conversation, didn't we, this week?
We did. We talked to the people from the data team and graphics team from the San Francisco Chronicle.
Yeah, Dan and Nami are doing incredible work. And this kicked off because of a piece that Nami did around the displacement of the Japanese population of San Francisco during internment, during the war, and the effect on the neighborhood afterwards. Fantastic visual and illustrative and mapping exercise all in one piece, which I think is interesting whether or not you live in the city.
It is a very interesting piece. We discuss what we found about it. It's a great combination of languages, maps, charts, illustrations. It's a beautiful, beautiful work. And we thought that it was worth bringing it to your, and when I say your, I mean our audience, attention.
Yeah, just the work of the team in being a local data journalism team in a interesting city and an area, because the Chronicle's kind of read beyond just San Francisco, is super relevant for anybody who wants to tell stories, data stories at a local level. So should we dive in?
Let's do it.
I'm Dan Koff. I'm the data editor with the San Francisco Chronicle.
And I'm Nami Sunita. I am a data visualization developer at the Chronicle.
Thank you so much for joining us. It's so great to have you here, not least because you cover the best city in the world, in my opinion. But tell us a little bit about, Dan, tell us a little bit first about the team and what you guys do, and then we can go from there.
Yeah, I think one notable thing about our data team here at the San Francisco Chronicle, it's been around for about 3 years, and we're part of a sort of burgeoning number of local data journalism teams across the US. We have people on our team who do data stories. So stories are based on a data set where data, I always use the term data is the main source of the story, and then people giving a context is the secondary element. And then we also have people who are data graphics specialists, and they make charts and interactives. And we also have data engineers, so people who are doing scraping and other back-end development work for elections and other such things.
And how big is the team again?
We're about six people.
Six people.
And we also have, you know, like I've heard on the podcast many times before, there every paper seems to have a different setup for the way things are divided. We have a design team at the Chronicle and then a data team. And we basically divide it up in that if graphics have data in them, we do them. And if the graphics don't have data in them, the design team does them.
If they do more infographic type of thing, like visual explanations and things like
exactly.
That.
Exactly. And certain maps, that's where actually it gets the most confusing, is whether a map should go to us or them. But yeah, that's a dividing line.
Yeah, I love that. It is wonderful to see the variety and the diversity of organizational structures in newsrooms, and that can all produce great work. And actually, I mean, one of the reasons why we are having this conversation is that we are obviously going to talk about the team and about your careers, where you come from, and so on and so forth. But we're also going to talk about a specific project that you produced around Japantown in San Francisco. that we will link in the episode notes, which is, in my opinion, once listeners look at it, they will see what I mean. But it's a great combination of different languages. It's like it combines text with illustrations, with animations, photographs, video. It's an incredible experience about how this neighborhood in San Francisco was devastated, essentially, by the what happened during World War II, where so many Japanese American citizens were interned by the government, and they were forced to move out from their homes. So I would like to begin by talking a little bit, not about the story itself, because we can talk about it later, but about its genesis. Because I think that there's a lot of personal stuff going on behind this story. There's a wonderful section at the very end in which you talk about the motivations to develop this story. So can you talk a little bit about that specific section in the story at the very end?
Yeah, I can talk a bit about that. So this story actually started like about a year ago. And so Dan and I were having conversations with Peter Hartlob, who is the main writer on the story, and his editor, Sarah Feldberg. And Peter often goes into the Chronicle archive and finds stories, finds old coverage and photos. And he had written a story using some of the photos that he had found. I think he wrote it maybe a year before that conversation. And it was about a Japanese family that had been incarcerated, and he had found photos and, you know, went to find that family. And so that was sort of the starting off point. And he wanted to collaborate with the data team to see if we could do a collaboration of like a data story and including stories that he found in the archive.
You know, I'm going to debate that a little bit version of it. I'm sure we have two different versions, but I would say that Nami has done a long series of stories on the way the Asian population has been changing in San Francisco and the Bay Area. Is a really important story in our community. And we were talking about, you know, looking more deeply at Japantown and the Japanese community, but how that was really not possible because the U.S. Census records didn't get into race ethnicity at a very detailed level going back before 1970. But what we realized is that the 1950 census had just become public record. So it had been 72 years since 1950, and that's when that becomes public record. So we were thinking, okay, well, actually we could do something that really shows for the first time like exactly how that community changed from 1940 to 1950. And at the same time, we knew that Peter had done all of this work and had been interested in the archives and telling this, you know, incredibly important story about our community. And I think that sort of we all just came together and we said, hey, we think we have a real opportunity to go big on this because of this 1950 census data. And we said, okay, let's do it. Let's try to get as many resources as we can to tell this story in the best way we can. Is that a fair?
Yeah. Yes, I'm underselling our part. Yeah.
What I really love about that section in the story is also that you sort of like disclose where you come from, which is something that I wish more journalists will do, because sometimes reporters sometimes take these stance, this sort of like view from nowhere, super objective stance. And this section at the very end, who worked in this story, is quite the contrary. It's like you say, I discovered this, or I read about this, or I have Japanese ancestry or whatever, Japanese heritage. And also the story in some sense is a tribute to your former creative director, Danielle Mollett Parks, who apparently advocated for this story to be created, right?
Yeah. Danielle really advocated for these like kinds of stories, these collaborations with the different parts of the newsroom. I think this is like one of the best collaborations that we've done, like personally. And I think everyone on the team feels this way. where like all of our strengths are like actualized in this project. And also like
multidisciplinary connections within the newsrooms, right?
Exactly. Yeah. And yeah, like the personal connections, like initially I felt kind of uncomfortable writing it. And Dan, I think, did a good job of kind of like talking through that. But I mean, you can talk through it, but I think like we all have, I don't know, connections to all of these different topics that we're talking about. And I think it's okay to state those.
Yeah, we had actually another story recently where Nami did a deep dive into Steph Curry, the basketball player here for the Golden State Warriors. And I always think it's fun. Nami has been learning over the last year a lot about basketball. She decided she wanted to cover basketball and do data-oriented stories. And I said, that's so fun for the audience to know that and to sort of be on this ride with you. And I think it's particularly important in local journalism to be like really connecting with the people in the community. We're here in the community. We want to connect with people. Like, and I think that is sort of also part of what makes people want to pay. And we are a business. And so the more we can show who we are to people, the maybe more they're going to want to stick with us.
I think so. It's such an interesting story. And it's so well done because you kind of combine art and illustration with data and mapping. And also it's like one of those stories, I think you could read it knowing San Francisco and knowing Japantown, but also read it if you've never been there and get an understanding because it's such an atmospheric piece. How important was it to you to think about like a broader audience? Are you aiming at an audience in the Bay Area or further afield?
I have to say, I don't think that we gave that a lot of thought. I think we generally are aiming for the Bay Area's audience. That is, you know, I think we come to almost every story thinking about that. And if it goes big and national, that would be awesome and exciting. And we do want people to know of our work in the rest of the country, partially because it's like good for us to be known for like recruiting purposes and for, you know, the, you know, pride within the newsroom. But as an organization, our goal is to serve the San Francisco Bay Area region. And so whenever we're doing almost anything, that's what we're thinking about. We're thinking about the people who are currently subscribers and may subscribe and how we can tell a story that will be meaningful for them and like improve their lives or help it make them richer.
Yeah, one of the interesting things that comes across as you kind of dive into the piece is the impact of internment after the war wasn't just on the Japanese community, was it? You talk about African American community and people being moved around the city along with the racism of the time. Could you talk a little bit more about that? And is that going to lead to more pieces, Nami?
Sorry, can you explain that a little bit more?
Yeah, so can you talk a little bit more about, I guess, like whether the long-term implications of what you wrote about here will kind of, is that going to result in more pieces for you? Is this like an area you could explore more further?
Yeah. I mean, I can see this. Well, so the Japantown community, you know, they were impacted after 1950, there was like redevelopment that happened in the 60s, and we sort of write about it in the piece. But there's, I mean, Japantown still exists. It has a very long history. But I think from a data perspective, we had access to the 1950 census records. And I mean, it'll be another decade until the 1960 census records come out. In conversations with researchers and community members, we heard that like the 1960s, the redevelopment that happened there really impacted the neighborhood as well, like almost as much as the executive order. And so like it would be great to do another sort of data dive into that, but the data isn't available yet. But yeah, I mean, we've talked, like I think Peter might write a few more, well, I'm not sure if that'll happen, but we've talked about possible pieces using some of the stuff that he's discovered in the archive. I think we could also look at other communities in San Francisco and how like different things have affected other people.
Yeah. So, well, let's step back a sec, because obviously I recommend everybody take a look at this piece, and great example of so many disciplines kind of working collaboratively at the same time. I'd love to talk a little bit about like covering San Francisco, because I feel, as somebody who lives there, that there is so much coverage of San Francisco. You say you're from San Francisco, if you're away, oh, are you okay? You know, and I love it here. I think it's an incredible city. It has obviously has its issues, all cities do. But why do you think it's become such a magnet for kind of coverage? It's not even the biggest city in the Bay Area. You know, Oakland, San Jose are both bigger, aren't they, than San Francisco? So why is it? What is it about San Francisco you think has led to it become such a magnet of coverage? A lot of it negative, people who don't know much about it.
Yeah, I think it's a couple of things. I mean, we are a city of incredible extremes, right? We, and the region in general, but San Francisco is home to some of the richest people in the world, some of the most successful companies in the world. And we are one of the most beautiful cities in the world, and we are one of the most left-wing voting cities in the entire country, though that is increasingly maybe not true, but still very, very left-wing. And at the same time, we have a huge number of problems. For example, really, really high overdose rates and a ton of people dying from fentanyl in the city. We also have a large number of homeless people unsheltered on the streets. Now, I actually don't think San Francisco is quite as unusual statistically on homelessness as sometimes made out to be, but we actually, the way the city is set up, the homeless population is very visible. They're really right around important parts of downtown and, you know, right next to the Twitter building. So unlike many other cities where the sort of homeless population is sort of shunted out to the outside of the city, it's actually very visible here. And I think that that's one of the things that has really creating this extreme wealth combined with this very visible poverty has made us really a center point for the issues with progressive politics or possible issues with progressive politics in America.
So Nami, maybe you can speak to this, but how often do you guys basically have to kind of like just counter established narratives with facts, essentially? How often are you countering kind of what people think compared to what's actually true?
Dan and I get this question a lot. I think because I work with a lot of like city hall people, metro people, and they often come to us being like, can we, you know, counter this narrative or support this narrative with data? Maybe some of the stuff that we've been working on about like the progressiveness of the city and how things are shifting. So in this last election, there's the moderate and the progressive faction in San Francisco. And there is sort of this narrative about San Francisco is becoming less progressive because certain moderate ballot measures have passed. And so we'll often use data on election results, look at precinct level data, see, you know, okay, maybe like overall the city is moving more moderately, but like there are certain pockets that are like stalwarts of like progressivism. They're still voting like majority progressive. So there are things like that that we'll use data to sort of check.
And I'll add that one thing that is really special is Nami has a background in math and is very technically accomplished. And so she can do things that, you know, before there was a data team at the Chronicle, we never could have done. So Nami's using the DW nominate algorithm to look at the supervisors now versus the supervisors and these sort of like our council members in San Francisco and how different they are, or, you know, compare the progressivity on state ballot measures over time. And these are things that, you know, 20 years ago at the Chronicle, they wouldn't have been possible for a variety of reasons. And I think it's very special to be able to do that in local news.
So I would like to go back to something that you mentioned before, and it's related to Simon's question about whether this is a local story with the potential of becoming a national story. So it may be the case that this is very local, I heard obviously about the what happened during World War II, but I didn't know about Japantown, the specific in San Francisco. So it's a story that appealed to me, right? And then the story is really well built. So for professional reasons, it was also really attractive to me. But what I thought while reading it, and I'm going to make a sort of like a comment first, and then I will ask you a general question, is that I think that this story is a model of how to conduct a very specific type of local journalism, which is about how injustices lead to negative social change, right? In this particular case, obviously, people being displaced from their homes. But, you know, it could be a template. It could be a model for stories that focus more on more sort of like more news, sort of newsworthy topics, things that are happening right now. For instance, right now in Miami, there's a very important local story about also displacement of people. Obviously, it's not because they are being interned, but they are being displaced. People are being displaced by gentrification. There is a specific neighborhood in Miami, Liberty City, for example, which is, you know, that Miami is almost completely flat. And I guess that this is not news, but we are threatened by climate change and sea level rise. And obviously, people want to move out from very low areas. They want to move to higher areas. And one of the highest areas in Miami is Liberty City, which is traditionally has traditionally been average low-income neighborhood, mostly African-American neighborhood. And the population who used to live there are essentially being bought out by the, the whole gentrification process. So while reading your story, I thought this could be sort of like a great model to sort of like tell that type of stories, like how people are being displaced by all these societal patterns that lead to injustice, essentially. So now comes the question: it's like you are a local newspaper, you're a local news organization. What have you learned through the development of this, of your story, that could be applied to other newsrooms, in particular used by other newsrooms, and in particular by newsrooms who don't have 6 people working in these type of things, in graphics and data? It's like, how can we create this type of a story about sort of things that are going right now, but when you have like 1 or 2 people, right, developing graphics or etc.?
Yeah, I mean, I think that is ultimately the big question for local newspapers is how much resources to put into a story, right? It's the biggest thing we face. You know, as you know, 6 people, it may seem like a lot, but there are so many stories we want to tell. And I think we're constantly saying, oh my God, the New York Times, Financial Times, all these places have so much resources and they can do so much stuff. And, you know, we just can't. And we have to pick and choose more. So like to your question earlier, I would love to be able to do something on what happened to Japantown in the 1960s and do an equivalent project, but we probably just can't, given like how many other stories we want to do. And frankly, I think my answer might be that it's okay to lower the ambition sometimes. You know, when we started in the first couple of years, we might do simple stories that just about how the demographics of a community were changing. So in this case of Liberty City, like you were talking about, Alberto, we might just do some maps about, okay, here's how the, you know, Black population or the Asian or Hispanic population of that community is changing over time, and try to do it in a way that's localized and nice looking. And, you know, and that's probably enough. And it's additive enough for the local audience to just do something that really provides some good context. And then eventually, when you find that you found a really something that's connecting to your audience, and Nami's stories on the Asian population and how they were changing in San Francisco was really connecting with our audience. And so we decided, okay, let's go big. After a couple of years of success on those stories, and really we had developed a lot of knowledge about it, then let's make our mark and try to do the 1 year long big time thing. And that's always my advice, is start incrementally and do additive things and then make your big push. I don't know, Nami, you're nodding. Does that seem right to you?
Yeah. I think I did like a couple stories on, or maybe three, about like how different groups and their like distribution, like where they live in San Francisco, has changed. And those were like, you know, level one, level two stories. And it was also a way for me to like get introduced to census data, because I had never really worked with census data. I didn't really know about like census geographies. And so I was getting acquainted with the data, finding ways to effectively visualize it. And then we were like, okay, we're ready for like the big project.
So obviously Chronicle is part of Hearst. You're part of a big network. Tell us a little bit about how that works for you guys. So obviously Hearst has been doing quite a lot around data journalism. So how, you know, do you get like support or resources that way, or are you kind of on your own day to day? How does it work normally?
So we are part of Hearst Newspapers, and there is sort of like a division under Hearst that's called the Dev Hub, and they are made up of developers, engineers, and I'm not really sure how big they are, maybe like 10-ish people. And they're kind of, they will create their own projects, do their own stories, but they will also assist us with, you know, engineering work. If we need help with scrapers, if we need help visualizing something, one really big area that they help us out in is in elections. So they help us scrape local data from the county election sites. And they'll build some of our live results pages. And then I will actually build the like city or county specific pages. So we usually have like a San Francisco county results page that I will build, but it's using the data that they have scraped and put into our servers.
I think a really cool part of it is that, you know, Hearst, some of the major newspapers under Hearst are San Francisco Chronicle, the Houston Chronicle, San Antonio News Express, Albany Times Union. And what we'll find is that if one place does a story that really succeeds with the audience, or we think is really high quality editorially, then the Dev Hub will help replicate that story for the other markets, particularly if it's a national data set. And that's been really successful. Really, really works well to have that network of local newspapers, because that makes us be able to compete with the Washington Post and the New York Times of the world a little bit better. And so, you know, when people look at our work, they're not just seeing it as, you know, no, it's not so good as these national outlets.
All right. A good portion of our audience is students or people who are beginning their careers in data journalism, and usually are very curious about the technologies behind the stories that we create. Can you talk a little bit about the tools that you used to develop all these visuals, the maps, the charts, the tables, et cetera, the illustrations?
Yeah, so for visualizations, I typically will use D3. That is my favorite JavaScript library. But for things that aren't too complex, we typically use DataWrapper. We have a subscription with them. And yeah, DataWrapper is very powerful. It can build a lot of different charts. And then for analysis, Google Sheets and R sometimes if it needs to be a more complex analysis.
Yeah, I'd say that we are increasingly amazed by DataWrapper. We're huge fans, and they've made the product better and better. We just they're small multiples now, as of like a month ago, and we really lost it when we found out that was there too. Though I will say, Nami's, you know, we still will find that even in sometimes they have a chart in DataWrapper, we'll still want to make it in D3 periodically if we want to have some choices that they don't offer, but it's really impressive.
DataWrapper is such an amazing thing. The fact that it's built by the community, I think, just makes it even more Powerful. Fantastic. Okay, so as is tradition, we have a couple of pop quiz questions for you that we ask all our guests. And I'm going to start with, and you can both answer this. What would you have done if you hadn't gone into journalism? I'm going to start with Nami for that.
I would probably, I think I would be working at a design company. So this is like back when I was applying for data viz related jobs, I had applied to newsrooms and design companies. And so I was interviewing at both. And in the end, I went to a newsroom, and I don't regret it, but I think I would have been doing design if I, you know, hadn't gone to a newsroom.
I think I'd be either an economist or a social worker. Those were the two paths I was on before journalism.
Fantastic. I love both those answers. I kind of feel like the design one's a bit of a cop-out because it's kind of you're doing that anyway. But I love the idea of just a social worker. That's brilliant. Alberto, do you want to go next?
Sure. Two or three or fewer than that books or classes or tutorials that really had an impact on you or shaped you as professionals?
I guess I was thinking about this question, and the statistician Andrew Gelman from Columbia has had a lot of influence on me, and I read his blog regularly, and I read his book, Data Analysis Using Regression. It sounds very complex, but it's actually very readable. And I was thinking of him because he's always helped me think about how to be more modest and be careful in how we communicate data and not sort of overdo it. And I think his work and studies, there's constantly studies coming at us from social science, and to make sure that we're saying, you know, there's a lot of, not everything is true that is said in a study, and we should be careful about that. So he's been really important to me.
He's also someone who has written extensively about philosophy of probability. So written about Bayesian versus frequency statistics. And he's a very clear writer. I really like him a lot too.
And he's written a lot about data viz too. I think he's very, very strong thoughts about that as well.
Nami, what about you?
I have three actually. So the first one is a book that actually Dan recommended on writing well. I don't have a journalism background. And so learning to write, I needed to do that sort of on the job. And Dan recommended this book, and it's really great for, yeah, writing concisely and well. So that's one. The second one is Interactive Data Viz for the Web. This is How I Learned D3 by Scott Murray. It's a great textbook. Yeah, that's like literally how I learned.
There's another San Francisco connection, right? So.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Yes, right. I had
now,
a note.
I think that Scott is right now. He's in Portland, I think. I think that he moved there. I'm not
yeah,
sure.
Yeah, he used to teach university here when we first did this. Cool.
Okay, and then my third book is The Wall Street Journal's Information Graphics Guide.
Donna Wong's book. Yeah,
it's a classic. Yes, that's how I learned to create very clean graphics.
Okay, since Nami did three, I'm putting one here.
Yeah,
The Elements of Statistical Learning by Trevor Hasty and several other people from Stanford. It is a terrific book for sort of beginning people to learn about machine learning and modern statistics. Really, really cool. So anytime I'm talking to people trying to get in this field, I would say that they should check it out.
Excellent choices. Okay, last one. I think we're throwing an extra one here. Pie charts or tree maps?
I will say tree maps, of course. And I've also written stories about pie charts and how loath they seem to be by many people in the graphics community. But of course, pie charts have their place. I'm sure that's what Nami might say. No.
Yeah, I'm not anti-pie charts. I think if you have fewer than like three categories, why not? Like, they look nice. People know how to read them. But yes, if it's like five different categories, go with the tree map.
Excellent choices, guys. Dan Kopf, Nami Samida, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.